Okay, September 13th, we're about to discuss the prophet Nahum in our weekly Bible study discussion. Nahum, we're past the time now of Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, and Amos. And even though
user in your channel timed out,
these books of the minor prophets aren't in the best chronological order, they could be. Nahum and Habakkuk are roughly contemporaries, Nahum and Joel are roughly contemporaries, and then Habakkuk and Zephaniah follow a short time later, before you have the final post-captivity prophets of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Nahum and Joel both seem to have been not long after the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, somewhere in the middle of the 7th century B.C. The 6th century B.C., 7th century B.C. Nineveh is destroyed in 612 B.C. The entire book of Nahum is...
User entered your channel.
...set at a time when Israel is already in captivity, which happened probably for the most part, by the end of the reign of Sennacherib, and then definitely by the end of the reign of Esarhaddon. 676 is the final year of a prophecy given in Jeremiah, where Yahweh told Isaiah, that in 60 and 365 years, which is 65 years, Ephraim would cease to be a nation. And that 65 years expired in the time of Esarhaddon, who ruled from 681 to 676
BC. Microphone muted.
After Esarhaddon, Ashurbanipal, his son, succeeded him and ruled for a long time, until 638 BC, I think, he was born in 685 BC. He ruled from 669 to 631 BC. So he ruled for 38 years. After Ashurbanipal died in 631 BC, two of his sons ruled in succession until 612 BC, and Nineveh was destroyed in 612 BC, and we have that date very well in archaeology, that was a right around within a year or two, the date that Nineveh was destroyed. Josiah, the king of Judah, died in 608 BC, and he was the last good king of Judah. So Joel, as well as Nahum, were sometime shortly before the beginning of the prophecies of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and they were after the prophecies having to do with Israel ended, and Israel was in captivity. And now Nahum's whole prophecy is a burden of Nineveh. It's an oracle against Nineveh that Yahweh is going to take vengeance on the Assyrians for what they had done to the children of Israel. Even if Israel deserved it, and Israel was destined to go into captivity. They were destined to go into captivity since it was prophesied all the way back in the words of Balaam in Numbers chapters 23, 24, and 25. Israel was destined to go into prophecy, to be taken into prophecy by Asher, by the Assyrians. But now, even though Yahweh used the Assyrian as the rod of his anger, which is what he called Assyria in the prophecy of Isaiah, I think in Isaiah chapter 10 or chapter 14, now he's going to punish the Assyrians for what they did, for their pride, for what they did to the children of Israel. In Numbers chapter 24, Balaam looked on the Kenites and said, "Strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in a rock. Nevertheless, the Kenites shall be wasted until Asher shall carry thee away captive." He's addressing in prophecy the children of Israel. So where it says, until Asher shall carry thee away captive, that thee is the children of Israel. So that was the first warning to the children of Israel that they were going to be taken into captivity by the Assyrians. That's how I read that passage. I think that's the only correct way to read it. So now we have Nahum chapter 1 and the burden of Nineveh. And this is sometime in the middle of the 7th century BC, before Nineveh is destroyed, but after Israel is taken into captivity. So I would date this to the reign of, possibly the late reign of Esarhaddon or Ashurbanipal, sometime between 676 and 631 BC. That's the closest we could get here.
Nahum chapter 1. The burden of Nineveh. The book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. God is jealous, and Yahweh revenges. Yahweh revenges and is furious. Yahweh will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. Yahweh is slow to anger and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. Yahweh has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry, and dries up all the rivers. Bashan languishes, and Carmel, and the flower of Lebanon languishes. The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence, yea, the world and all that dwell therein. Who can stand before his indignation, and who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by him. Yahweh is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knows them that trust in him. But with an overrunning flood he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. What do you imagine against Yahweh? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. For while they be folded together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble fully dry. There is one come out of you that imagines evil against Yahweh, a wicked counselor. Thus saith Yahweh, though they be quiet and likewise many, yet thus shall they be cut down when he shall pass through. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. For now will I break his yoke from off you, and will burst your bonds asunder. And Yahweh has given a commandment concerning you, that no more of your name be sown. Out of the house of your gods will I cut off the graven image and the molten image. I will make your grave, for you are vile. Behold upon the mountains the feet of him that brings good tidings, that publishes peace. O Judah, keep your solemn feasts, perform your vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off. End of Nahum chapter 1.
You caught me almost at the definition of Carmel here. I just wanted to verify it. It's interesting that, okay, Strong's defines it as a planted field or a garden. I'm looking at the Bible works. Strong's data says garden land. Elkoshite. It's not clear what an Elkoshite is, if that's a place, or if that's the name of one of his ancestors. Elkoshite, Elkoshi means God, supposedly means God, the ensnarer, which is a reference to, I believe, to the fact that Yahweh God has trapped Israel and has trapped Assyria, even though Assyria took Israel into captivity. that Assyria would be ensnared by that action. And I think that word Elkoshite, it may not be a place at all, or it may not be an ancestor of Nahum's at all. It might just represent the fact that God is ensnaring Assyria, that it's, even though Israel was taken into captivity, it's going to be Assyria that's going to be destroyed. Assyria at this time had been a mighty empire since the 14th century BC. It had dominated the region since 700 years before this. So Bashan means fruitful, and Carmel means garden land or garden, and Lebanon means whiteness. So because the fruitful garden land of God that's white is dried up, and Assyria is going to be punished for that. That's the way I look at this passage. And that's not in my original commentary on Nahum. I didn't really get into the meanings that much, I don't think, of those terms. But Assyria was a tool in the hand of God, and now Assyria itself would be destroyed. They're ensnared by Yahweh because they were an empire first, which is wrong in the eyes of God. And second, they were mingled with all the Canaanites of their own region. They dominated. They were under subjection to the Mitanni Empire for a couple of hundred years until that the Hittites destroyed the Mitanni Empire, and then Assyria began to rise to power. So the Assyrians folded in all of the surrounding peoples, including all of the peoples of those Canaanite empires, into their own empire. So we don't know to what extent they became a mixed race empire, or how quickly the population itself mingled their race with the others. But it's obvious that every empire, once that happens to a nation, that it goes on that path, it's inevitable that it's going to become all mixed.
And that's how the flower of whiteness languisheth.
Yes. Definitely. That's how the Garden of Whiteness is destroyed in Bashan, Carmel, and Lebanon.
And Nahum means comfort. So when Assyria, which ensnared Israel, is destroyed, that's a comfort to the children of Israel.
Yes, and that's a good observation also. I hadn't looked at the actual meaning of Nahum yet. I think I had that. I did explain that in my prophecy, perhaps. I don't remember. In my prophecy, in my commentary on the prophecy of Nahum, I think I may have touched on that. I'm not sure.
And when I read Nahum, I often read it thinking about Babylon today. And there's like a few reasons for that. And one is that just naturally all the empires which have oppressed us ever since our captivity began have pretty much all been the same. So Nineveh is just easily a type for Mystery Babylon. But I noticed recently that in Zephaniah chapter 2, Yahweh says, speaking of Nineveh, that she says that I am and there is none except me, which is a humanist attitude, which is also reflected on Babylon in Isaiah 47, and also on Mystery Babylon in Revelation, when the whore says that I'm not a widow, I haven't known grief. So I think when you read Nahum, it's pretty easily a type as well for the fall of Mystery Babylon. And I think there's a few things in here which you could read as corresponding with that, like here in the first chapter, he rebukes the sea and makes it dry. And that just makes us think of Revelation when the sea is no more. And there's a few other things that I've noticed in the past, but something just right now that's really caught my eye is in the Septuagint in verse 15. So I'm just opening it here. It says, for they, speaking of the wicked, for they shall no more pass through you to your decay. And that makes me think of how when we accept aliens amidst us and we take on their gods, they really make us decay. And it seems that Assyria, being an empire, this is actually speaking of Judah,
I suppose. But regardless, being an empire, having them mixed with you brings you to decay. Whenever Judah or Israel had good dealings with the Assyrians, even though they were Asher and they were white, they had a lot of aliens with them. And by doing so, that often probably brought them to decay. And I just found that interesting how that's there in the Septuagint, but it's not in the Masoretic. They shall no more pass through you to your decay.
I have one problem with that, and that's the fact that the Greek is a third person singular noun. Passing through you, to pass through you is fine. And then there's a verb which means to wrestle, and it is actually an active third person plural verb, which would be to strive. And then there's a passive third person singular verb, and two passive third person singular verbs, one meaning to accomplish your removal. And they're third person verbs. They're not second person verbs. I don't know why Brenton, and if you see that to thy decay, that thy is in italics and it's not in the original. There's no your in the original. It's speaking of his in the original.
Hmm.
So I have to reject the Septuagint there and Brenton's translation.
Okay, I just noticed it now, so it'll just, I was thinking off on the moment.
He is utterly cut off is seems to be a better representation of the Hebrew of the passage, honestly. He is utterly destroyed would probably be better, but the word can mean to be cut off or to be cut. So I would have to side with the King James Version there. Because Brenton, that thy is just made up. It's made up. It doesn't belong here. It's in italics. And they are third person singular verbs. So it's speaking about his being cut off. It's passive. The verb that means to remove or drive away is passive, meaning that it's third person singular, and the recipient of the action is the third person that it's speaking about, his or well, it can't be there because it's singular. So, yeah, it's I can't translate all the Greek right now, but because I'd want to look better at some of the definitions of these words, that this wrestle, these three verbs in a row is always a little problematical, but they're all third person. Strive to complete his removal. They will no longer pass from you. That's an aorist active verb, and then there's a perfect passive third person singular verb, and then there's a perfect passive third person singular verb. Again, it's three verbs in a row, and one's aorist active, which to me I would translate as that is he would strive and it would accomplish his removal. So I would want to take a better look at the entire context of the passage, meaning 115 is actually 2:1 in the Septuagint, right? Meaning I would want to translate the passages before this one from the Greek before I translated this passage so that I have a good grip on the context. But it's definitely third person verb speaking about his removal and his striving and his removal. So yeah, I reject Brenton's translation there. It's wrong.
And I guess when they're removed, it sort of paved the way for the gospel to ultimately come. It was like one move in a grand game, because it's interesting how this verse has that parallel prophecy here to the gospel, which we see in Isaiah.
Reading Strabo, both Strabo and Diodorus Siculus, and I'm sure I touch on this in my German origins papers. In subsequent years, probably from before the time of Herodotus forward, the people known as Cimmerians and Scythians dominated that entire region, and what used to be Media and part of Assyria became known as Sacca Sane after the Sacca, right, which was the Persian name for the Scythians. And they dominated that entire area, where Josephus said that those 10 tribes live beyond Euphrates and are an innumerable multitude. He had to be speaking about those Scythians.
Yes, and they were really taking land which was once a part of the Assyrian Empire, right?
Yes. Yes, they were. So the Israelites were augmented. And the Assyrians, after the fall of their empire, were severely diminished. They didn't disappear, but they were severely diminished.
So there's like a subtle inference here in Nahum that the destruction of Nineveh is going to, in one minor or major step, lead towards the gospel and the reconciliation of Israel.
Well, it's going to open the way for that to be possible, because the Israelites in the north wouldn't have any competition from them anymore. And once Nineveh was destroyed, they'd be able to better migrate out of that region, which they did in large numbers, but they never all left. It's like any other time that our people have went and settled in a broad land, that they leave in streams, in colonies, right, as the population grows. Like the East Coast of the United States was all settled by 1776, but the Midwest wasn't settled heavily and significantly until the 1830s, maybe 1820s. People started to stream west in small groups and settle in various areas.
I guess it's sort of like when you have a farm, you don't want to leave it, but your son might want to find land for his own.
Well, I mean, if you have four sons, one of them's going to inherit the farm and the other three are going to hit the road. Yeah. If they have families, they're going to want to go.
Yeah.
They're not going to want to stay subject to the older son when all of this land is open in the West for the taking, basically. So, yeah, they're going to stream away.
Hey, Bill, in this verse 15 here, it sounds a lot like that verse in Isaiah, you know, behold him who publishes peace. But this sounds a lot more localized, because it's after the fall of Assyria. So it's like they're not under the burden of Syria anymore. So how would you connect that to the gospel?
We were just talking about that.
Yeah, but this one's more local. So it's to do with the Assyria being cutting it off. So I'm not sure how you're making the...
I'll tell you the connection I would make. O Judah, keep thy solemn feasts.
Yeah.
In other words, the children of Israel are being taken away, but if Judah keeps the solemn feasts, then ultimately the gospel will be published.
Because it's like you say, that Second Temple period was only, you know, maintained to bring in the Messiah.
That's it. That's the only reason. That's the reason given in Daniel chapter 9, right? There can't be any other reason.
Yeah, I was thinking that when I saw that, keep thy solemn feast and perform thy vows, that could refer to that period for sure. Yeah, that is a good point.
Yeah, to me, this is an explicit indication that Israel was going into captivity and would stay in captivity, that Assyria would be destroyed, that Israel would be augmented after Assyria is destroyed, and Judah is left with only a commandment to keep the solemn feasts, and that would lead to the publishing of the gospel.
And when this is mentioned in Isaiah, is Judah mentioned there too? Let me go back and check.
No, I don't think so.
No, yeah. No. So this adds a whole new angle.
Yeah, but this is... Isaiah is not inaccurate, but this is in one manner more precise. That happens often throughout the prophets.
Yeah, you see different angles in different prophets.
And when we put the angles together, then we get a more complete story.
Sort of like the Gospels, basically.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure if like the Assyrians were still around when the remnant went back, they would have been a huge thorn in their side. Probably way more than the Samaritans and all those nations in Ezra and Nehemiah.
Well, what we had there is one to come out of thee that imagines evil against Yahweh, a wicked counselor. We really can't identify that person, right? I mean, we don't know. I don't think there are any Assyrian records recording any intentions against the Cymry once they were taken into captivity. I never saw anything that would lead me to associate it with that passage, right?
Yeah, it makes me think of that Assyrian general in 2 Kings, but this is too long after that for that to make sense.
Yeah.
Verse 2 is pretty cool. It's a good verse for that Yahweh chastises his children but has vengeance on his enemies.
Yes, that's the whole tone of Nahum, really.
Verse 8 lends to what you were saying earlier, Noble, with the flood.
Yeah. And darkness shall pursue his enemies. That sort of reminds me of Egypt, when they had darkness in all their dwellings, and Solomon sort of reflects on that in his wisdom.
Right. There's always going to be parallels with prophecies or records of judgment. We should know that history always follows the same general patterns.
Yeah.
So when we see those patterns start to evolve, we should know what to expect, or at least in some one form or another. When you see the beginning of these patterns start to develop, then you should just know what to expect. Don't be surprised.
Didn't Christ say something like, when you see the leaves of the fig tree are tender, you should know that the spring is near?
Yeah. Something like that.
I'm sure people in their stubbornness scoffed at Nahum, though, because Assyria was seen as so invincible.
Right. Now, there's one other angle on this that I did have in my commentary I noticed it as we were talking. And that's this Elkosh. I did find a town named Alkosh, and that doesn't take away from the symbolism of the name. But I did find a town named Alkosh in what is now northern Iraq, which allegedly dates to Assyrian times, and that's plausible. So if that is the Elkosh from which Nahum comes, then he may have been an Israelite of the captivity. That's possible. And somehow his book was published and it was preserved. Maybe it was preserved through the captivity in Babylon of Judah later on, or maybe it made its way back to Jerusalem. I can't say, we can't say, but somehow it was preserved. That's possible, because there's no indication in this prophecy that Nahum is from Judah or Jerusalem. But since we see a message in here for Judah, why wouldn't the prophet send a copy of his prophecy to Jerusalem? They had to have that ability to do that.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point.
So he may have been of the captivity in northern Iraq would actually be northern Assyria, or beyond the bounds of the north of Assyria proper. So that's very plausible. It's a little circumstantial, but it's very plausible. Because we have no indication of names of priests. We have no indication that he's of Judah or in Jerusalem. And of course, Yahweh did choose other men of Israel as prophets that were not of priests or of Levi or of Judah.
Amos is one, I think.
And Amos is definitely an example. And evidently so is Jonah, an example, a plausible example. There's, a lot of people claim Nahum must come from Capernaum. And I don't accept that, because the Capernaum, that this claim that he was named for, that city was named for the prophet, but I don't accept that. I think it just means city of comfort. That's all it means. So it shares the same name as Nahum, but it wasn't named for him, and that's not where he's from. Galilee was already taken into captivity. I guess we commence with Nahum chapter 2.
Well, the last thing I wanted to say was at verse 5, we see that even the hills will melt. But if you take refuge in the Lord, you will still be protected, those who trust in him. So this whole world could melt away and we would still stand in the name of God.
Yeah, that feels like a really good temporal salvation verse. And when I read that, thinking of the fall of Babylon, I think of the second advent, and the mountains are the big nations and the hills are the small nations. And we just hope that Yahweh will protect us in that day.
Yeah, that's an interpretation that is compares or earlier, and I have to agree with it.
Nahum chapter 2. He that dashes in pieces is come up before your face. Keep the munition, watch the way, make your loins strong, fortify your power mightily. For Yahweh has turned away the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. The shield of his mighty men is made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the fir trees shall be terribly shaken. The chariots shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. He shall recount his worthies. They shall stumble in their walk. They shall make haste to the wall thereof, and the defense shall be prepared. The gates of the rivers shall be opened, and the palace shall be dissolved. And Huzab shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maids shall lead her as with the voice of doves, tabering upon their breasts. But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. Take ye the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold. For there is none end of the store and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart melts, and the knees smite together, and much pain is in all loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness. Where is the dwelling of the lions, and the feeding place of the young lions, Where the lion, even the old lion, walked, and the lion's whelp, and none made them afraid. The lion did tear in pieces enough for his whelps, and strangled for his lionesses, and filled his holes with prey, and his dens with ravin. Behold, I am against thee, saith Yahweh of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. And I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall no more be heard. End of Nahum chapter 2. Nineveh's on a pool of waters, sort of how the whore of Babylon sits upon many waters.
Right, that pool of water is supposed to be it's evidently supposed to be a sign of earthly or worldly comforts. So Babylon sits upon many waters. In the promotion of water at this time was, of course, necessary for the conveyance of trade of material goods. It was the easiest way that a few men could carry many material goods for long distances, what were on ships. The water was crucial to trade. The rivers were the highways of the ancient world. So Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. She had that control of that trade and was a source of worldly comfort to the people that she ruled over. Just like Babylon today. Look at how many people are just caught up in the comforts of the world. That's how I see that. That's the meaning that I put to that. So Mystery Babylon sits upon many waters, right? Just like Tyre sat upon the water. It was a city, a center of trade. And Babylon itself was a center of trade that sat upon the water.
Microphone activated.
Bill, could you mention or speak of, they say that the fire of Nineveh actually helped to preserve all of the ancient documents or inscriptions?
Well, I mean, the buildings collapsed on top of the ancient libraries of all their... The Hittites did the same thing. The Hittites, the Assyrians, they kept all their inscriptions. They kept all their decrees and their records in these inscriptions on clay tablets. They recorded these, and the kings recorded their deeds on certain inscriptions and certain stelae. So the buildings, the government buildings in which these records were kept, collapsed. And because the sand niggers that dwelt there in later times never really cared to dig in the ground and look for anything, that preserved them for British and French and German archaeologists of the 19th century.
It's amazing.
So when the archaeologists saw these cities, they started digging in the ground and they found these tablets. And there are actually hundreds of thousands of records from Assyria, more than any other place. More than they've translated. They've only translated a fraction of them so far. They're not all translated. I mean, it might be half, it might be a quarter. They're not all translated.
Isn't there the period of the fishermen, Bill, and then there's the period of the hunters, and then the period of those who, you know, look in the rocks? I remember Clifton writing about that, but I can't remember
right,
the
exact.
Yeah, Jeremiah.
Jeremiah 16:16, I'm pretty sure.
And so that's exactly what that is, isn't it, Bill?
That absolutely, I believe that. And that was actually Clifton's original thought. As far as I know, it was Clifton's original thought. I can't take credit for that one. That was all Clifton. He figured that out. And he presented it to me. I remember when he sent me that pamphlet, the proofread. I said, wow, this is pretty good. It was pretty good. So I was impressed with that.
Yeah, and so that fulfills the prophecy. Like, the niggers aren't going to be digging in the ground. It's going to be our folk, and that fulfills the prophecy.
They don't. They only on rare occasions, they think they might be able to eat or profit something. But no, they don't dig in the ground. They don't care about history or archaeology. They have no care. Look at Egypt. How many monuments in modern Iraq and Iran? How many monuments and graves and things that they've looted just to try to make money off it? They only care about the money.
And now these days they cry and say, oh, those white people stole our stuff because it's worth money now. They imagine they're going to become wealthy.
Right. So they do. They want all kinds of relics back from the museums in Europe. Hey, give us that back. That's ours.
It's not even theirs, though.
Right.
I find it ironic that so Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire was destroyed by a coalition of the Babylonians, the Medes, and the Scythians. So the Scythians actually worked to preserve their own history by destroying a city.
Yes. And the Persians. Yes. Yeah. That's something I was going to get into towards the end, that this coalition of groups that were all subject to Assyria got together and destroyed Assyria. So they all had their virtual liberty after that. And that's when I believe the Cimmerians actually crossed Anatolia. And that's when the Scythians began to migrate northwards. So there wasn't another empire until Nebuchadnezzar started reconstructing the old Assyrian empire by going out and conquering all the states that were formerly subject to Assyria. That started in 606 BC, 605 BC. It didn't take long, maybe 7 years after Nineveh was destroyed and Assyria fell. But there was a long period of decay in Assyria. Ashurbanipal was the last solid king of Assyria until 631 BC. His two sons, two of them ruled in succession because one of them lived only 4 years and died in 627 BC. And the other one ruled from 627 to 612 BC for 15 years. But their rules over the Assyrian Empire were both very shaky and filled with contenders to the throne that were challenging them. And they could hardly keep a grip on the empire that their father had. So that they just weren't able to keep it. Of course, the reason why they weren't able to keep it is the will of Yahweh outlined here in Nahum.
Wasn't one of them killed in the temple of their gods by his brother?
I'm not entirely certain of that.
There's something similar to that, I think, in 1 Samuel, but it's the Philistines there.
No,
it is frequently assumed without any supporting evidence that Asher Etilalani's brother, Sin Sariskin, fought with him for the throne. So evidently that's an assumption, but there's no evidence. And that's just Wikipedia. I haven't studied this history in that depth. Although the exact circumstances of Asher Etilalani's death and the rise of his brother Sin Sariskin to the throne are unknown, there is no evidence to suggest that he was killed and deposed in a coup. So that's what we have in a Wikipedia article for Asher Etilalani, who was the successor to Ashurbanipal, his father. So I haven't looked for inscriptions from that time because it really is not directly connected to the fate of the children of Israel who destroyed Assyria just a few years later.
Right.
Is it possible here, Bill, that where it says in verse 2, and marred their vine branches, is it possible that that's a reference to fornication? It reminds me of Jeremiah 2, speaking of Judah and the degenerate vine before me.
Well, this is speaking about the emptiers of Israel and marred their vine branches. It could refer to the deaths of the many Israelites that died in battles and trying to defend themselves against the Assyrians?
Yeah, this verse to me seems more like the young men dying in battle.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at the Hebrew word. It also means destroy, so that would make sense.
I'm sure at least many of the women were raped. That's all. That always happens in war, right?
When that's why you don't want to have women. Another,
it's inevitable that the soldiers are going to rape their women.
Yes, you don't want them on the front lines.
You well, I mean, they were taken into captivity, and I'm sure a lot of them were probably raped.
I don't know if it's rape, but I know we our ancestors even took some Midianite wives, I believe, and they were white because they descended from Keturah, the wife of Abraham.
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't know if that was rape, but we took woman as booty.
It's happened from the dawn of time. It's all over European records. It began Troy. Look at the Battle of Troy. There's all kinds of tragic poets. The tragic poets, there's all kinds of plays. Hecuba comes to mind, right? The former wife of Hector, I believe. That there's all kinds of plays. There's like half a dozen plays probably portraying the fates of different various Trojan women after the Trojan War, because they were all taken booty by various of the Greek heroes, right?
It also happened in the time of Moses. The Israelites did it.
Yes. They did it to certain groups. They didn't do it to others.
Right.
White so groups. They did it to the Midianites in Numbers chapter 30, I think, or something like that. But they didn't do it, hopefully, to the Canaanites. They weren't supposed to anyway. They were supposed to kill them all. Yahweh told them to kill them all, man, woman, and child.
Right. There's no evidence. There's no scripture that says they did it to anyone else other than that group, as far as I remember.
But the pagan nations wouldn't have any restrictions to who to do it to.
Right, exactly. Because they don't have that law.
If the story in the Iliad about Paris and Helen of Troy, if that's not completely mythical, like I know like it all happened, but I think there's embellishments. And if that's not an embellishment, if that part was true, it's always sort of stood out to me how this giant war basically took place over a woman.
Yeah, no, it's not true at all. That was over the shipping channels and control of the shipping channels. The Greeks wanted it from the Trojans.
Yeah, I always felt like an embellishment to me. I'm like, this, well, seriously,
it might have been, it might have actually happened, but it would have been used as an excuse by Agamemnon to start the war.
Oh, right. Yeah, I see right. What you mean.
You read the opening passages of Herodotus where he blamed it all on the Phoenicians for stealing other people's women.
Right.
And extended that down to the Trojans for stealing Helen of Troy. Herodotus blamed it all on lust and sex and stealing each other's women.
Yeah, but it's really about money and power.
I've got Deuteronomy 21 up. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home and have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she is wearing when captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, so that they get a month, then you may go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. So we're a bit more noble in this thing. You know, we give them a month to mourn when we capture them.
That's a good one, Joe. I forgot about that one.
Okay, but even with that, Joe, even with that law cannot allow you to transgress the other laws. That an Ammonite can't enter the congregation, that a Moabite can't enter the congregation, that you're to exterminate all the Canaanites and have nothing to do with them.
Right, but yeah, but Yahweh let them do it with the Midianites because they were from Keturah.
Right, it's not forbidden in law.
I can imagine them all fighting over a pretty girl, like, oh, she's the prettiest, I'm taking her, and then they're almost turning on each other.
Well, it was pretty much.
I was just going to say, that's actually the theme of some of those Trojan women stories. that certain of the Greeks competed, and some of them were disappointed that the other guy got a certain woman. Yes. They were whoremongering. They were doing, I mean, these women were captive victims, but they were basically whoremongering. I'm getting that one, not you. I'm getting him. We're going to fight for her. And I think that happened also.
Yeah, the pagans were less refined. You know, in the Bible, they're given a month, but the pagans, they wouldn't have given them a month. They would have just been like, you know, they wouldn't have done the month, I don't think. It's nice. It's nice that they gave them a month to mourn.
They also wouldn't have shaved their heads.
Yeah, that seems like a bad idea to me. But that's what Yahweh says to do, so you do it.
Right, but a pagan would never do that.
Yeah, they wouldn't.
That's because it represented mourning, right? Shaving your head.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, I think so.
Had to add that in there, thanks.
Okay, I thought Ajax the Great was killed by Odysseus, competing with Odysseus for a woman, but no, he was competing with Odysseus for the armor of Achilles, I think it was. Okay. I thought it was for a woman, but it was for armor. Which was also another thing that men competed for on the battlefield. When a warrior fell, it was like, who's going to get his armor? I don't know why you'd want the armor of a dead man. It didn't protect him.
Yeah. I can imagine some, you know, greedy guys just like forgetting the war and just starting to like loot as much as they can, while the more noble ones are trying to finish the war and win the war.
World War II, I mean, Nazis, the Allies were constantly taking all the guns and stuff they could off the dead bodies of the Nazis. They brought so many guns back to the U.S. It was incredible. Some guys brought like a dozen guns back with them or more.
They took the watches too. Germans culturally had watches. They all wore watches, and the Allies took all their watches. Which seems pretty petty, but that's what they did.
Watches were valuable back then, though. They weren't the $10 Timexes we buy in Walmart today.
Right. They were nice.
And when I was a little kid in the 60s, a nice watch was actually treasured. And they were actually still made here, a lot of them. When the plastic LCD and LED watches came out, watches got cheap and became junk. And the good watches became like $10,000 Rolexes that nobody could ever afford unless they were a Jew.
We're going to do the next chapter.
Yeah, I don't know if we're really done with this chapter. Do you think? Huzab shall be led away captive. That means stand upright, to take one stand, to establish that. It seems to be a little message in there that the Assyrian could take his stand, but he's going to be taken away captive.
Microphone muted.
Okay, I guess we could roll with chapter 3 and finish now.
Nahum chapter 3. Woe to the bloody city. It is all full of lies and robbery. The prey departs not. The noise of a whip, and the noise of the rattling of the wheels, and of the prancing horses, and of the jumping chariots. The horseman lifts up both the bright sword and the glittering spear, and there is a multitude of slain, and the great number of carcasses, and there is none end of their corpses. They stumble upon their corpses. Because of the multitude of the whoredoms of the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts, that sells nations through her whoredoms, and families through her witchcrafts. Behold, I am against you, saith Yahweh of hosts, and I will discover your skirts upon your face, and I will show the nations your nakedness, and the kingdoms your shame. And I will cast abominable filth upon you, and make you vile, and will set you as a gazing stock. And it shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee from thee, and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforters for her? Are you better than populous No, that was situate among the rivers, that had the waters around about, whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from the sea? Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and it was infinite. Put and Lubim were thy helpers. Yet was she carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed in pieces at the top of all the streets. And they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. You also shall be drunken. You shall be hid. You also shall seek strength because of the enemy. All your strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first ripe figs. If they be shaken, they shall even fall into the mouth of the eater. Behold, your people in the midst of you are woman. The gates of your land shall be set wide upon your enemies. The fire shall devour your bars. Draw thee waters for the siege. Fortify your strongholds. Go in today and tread the mortar. Make strong the brick kiln. There shall the fire devour you. The sword shall cut you off. It shall eat you up like the cankerworm. Make yourself many as the cankerworm. Make yourself many as the locust. You have multiplied your merchants above the stars of heaven. The cankerworm spoils and flies away. Your crowned are as the locusts, and your captains as the great grasshoppers, which camp in the hedges in the cold day. But when the sun arises, they flee away, and their place is not known where they are. Your shepherds slumber, O king of Assyria. Your nobles shall dwell in the dust. Your people is scattered upon the mountains, and no man gathers them. There is no healing of your bruise. Your wound is grievous. All that hear the bruit of thee shall clap the hands over thee. For upon whom is not your wickedness passed continually? End of the book of Nahum.
Wonderful. Okay, so this noble is definitely, these first six verses are definitely set Nineveh up as a type for Mystery Babylon. But every empire is like this. Every empire is a people in a nation who are convinced that they should whore themselves off to all these other nations so that they could grow an empire and profit from these other nations.
Yeah,
every empire in history, the same pattern. Every single empire in history becomes a whore, whoring themselves with all these other nations in order to become an empire.
Yeah, it's just natural, but Yahweh is definitely giving us a signal here on how to read this prophecy in the far vision.
Yes, absolutely. I really believe this is, because historical patterns repeat itself, that this is a type and a far vision for the fall of Mystery Babylon, which is just the same pattern replaying itself out again that's prophesied in a very similar way in Revelation chapter 18.
Somebody recently in the chat was talking about human trafficking. And here in verse 4, where it says that sells nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts, that makes me think of human trafficking.
Well, human trafficking was replete in Amos, and when Tyre, the Tyrians, the Edomites were all reprimanded for taking the people of the children of Judah in human trafficking and selling them into slavery and prostitution. Human trafficking is as old as time.
Called it slavery back then.
Yeah, they called it slavery, but it was human trafficking.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it was for the purposes of prostitution. Slaves were sold to temples or dedicated to temples, and the temples used those slaves if they were attractive, whether they were male or female, they became temple prostitutes. If they were young and attractive. If they were old and unattractive, they were given other tasks, like laundry or whatever, working the fields, whatever. Now I had forgotten when I did my introduction, I had dated Nahum to between 676 BC and 631 BC. I had forgotten that this reference to No was in chapter 3 of Nahum. I mean, it's been 10, 12 years since I did my commentary on Nahum. But this is mentioned in my commentary. No was looted by Ashurbanipal in 663 BC. So that this must have occurred, this prophecy of Nahum's must have been given shortly after that, or that would event would be a memory. No is a reference to Thebes in Egypt. And it's recorded in inscriptions that Ashurbanipal had sacked Thebes and destroyed Thebes around 663 BC.
Then it had infinite strength build. You know, that feels a lot like today, where a lot of people think, you know, this current world order has infinite strength.
Right.
Yet she was carried away.
Right. It's really on pretty thin eyes, if you look at it. If you look at the structure of our military and the substance of our military, it could very well destroy itself.
Verse 6, and I will cast abominable filth upon thee and make you vile. Now, my first thought reading that was maybe Yahweh gave them a reprobate mind, sort of how he did to Rome. But if the grammar here is correct, it seems he's talking about the future. And maybe a better interpretation would be all those sand monkeys that would sit on the ruins of Nineveh for generations.
Microphone activated.
Well, I'm wondering at verse 16, if the cankerworm that spoileth and flieth away could be, you know, the population, you know, that's been brought, you know, the mixed population. Because you've got the, you know, in speaking of what you said, Noble, because you've got these merchants multiplied above the stars of heaven, and then the cankerworm comes in. So is this like, could this be, these cankerworms be part of the population of Babylon? Because that's what we got today.
I think even in the near vision of Joel, because we often talk about the far vision of Joel, and that's all the locusts here today, but I think the near vision of Joel was what Assyria did to Israel. And even though Asher was white, they were viewed as locusts and grasshoppers. So whatever the case is here, it's sort of interesting how the tables have turned on Nineveh. And the tables have turned. Now they're suffering from grasshoppers and locusts.
Yes. I agree with that. But here it says, make thyself many as the cankerworm. Make thyself many as the locust.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw even if they make themselves like that, they're still going to be overrun. But I still wondered, I hear you.
Thy shepherds slumber, O king of Assyria. And doesn't, in other words, the leaders and Not only the religious, but the political leaders of Assyria did not see this coming. They slumber. And that's another pattern that's common throughout the fall of empires.
God,
they sit in their own pride and they imagine everything's going to be like it is today, that they're too powerful to fall so they could party and do what they want.
That verse 13, behold, thy people in the midst of thee are women. I think that lends to what you're saying, because it's the effeminate, comfortable life that men have these days.
Right.
Another common theme of all empires that get too fat for too long.
Well, right, absolutely. And where it says that they'll make themselves hideous or whatever the word is, I lost the passage already, but we had just discussed it. I mean, they were probably flying rainbow flags back then too. Okay, gentlemen, I'll be right back. Y'all could keep this going, but I'll be right back.
Yeah, when it says your people are women, it does make me think of faggots.
Well, it's just the nature of even men who are heterosexual.
Well, yeah,
these days, right? I think that it's not like the men that were around a few hundred years ago. I mean, not anymore, not as a group, although there are obviously exceptions. And it's just like happens from living too comfortably for too long and all the other things that Bill was saying.
Like you're saying that, and when the men are like that, the gates are wide open.
Right.
Unto our enemies. There's no one to protect the women either, because they're just, the gates are wide open, the enemy walks in easily, no resistance.
You know, it reminds me.
We're trying to make friends with them. It's like, come on in, we're friends.
When Cyrus, this is a different war obviously, but when Cyrus took over Lydia, he conquered it, he subdued it, and then he left. And no sooner did he leave, but they had a rebellion within a few days. And he set his mind to go back and completely destroy the Lydians. And he asked his counselors what they think. And one of his counselors was Croesus, the former king of Lydia. He took him as a counselor. And he said, no, don't annihilate them. Just turn them into a nation of women, make them merchants. So forbid them from working fields and traditional manly jobs, and make them all just be buyers and sellers of goods. And that's what he did. And he used the same terminology, make them a nation of women. And that's kind of like what we are now, right? I mean, for the most part, everybody's a buyer and seller, and fewer people are actually doing things that they should be doing or traditionally did do. I mean, I'm speaking of men.
No one produces anything. Most of the people, you know, have worthless degrees and things like that, and they just give stupid opinions, etc. Yeah, no one produces anything, David.
Yeah. For the most part, our society is not built on that any longer, and we've exported all those jobs. And you know, there's so many fluff jobs now, you know, in government and corporations, where you could probably erase like 50% of the jobs and it wouldn't really matter, you know.
Right. Like how important is human resources?
Yeah, you know, it looks to me that if you look at the populations of small factory towns in the early 1900s, say in America, and the number of factory employees in those towns, it seems to me that every manufacturing job could support two service jobs, at least. So in other words, if you had 100 manufacturing employees in a town with those men tied up in manufacturing, you could probably have 200 service jobs in that town, with men who are serving that factory in other ways, or who are serving those manufacturing employees in other ways, like butchers, bakers, dairy farmers, and all those other jobs would support those manufacturing employees and that manufacturing center, which was actually producing goods that were for export.
Right.
Right. So I think that every manufacturing job can probably support 2 to 3 service jobs.
Yeah, that happened in my hometown when NAFTA came along and all the jobs left. It was a steel town, and all the secondary jobs and I guess tertiary jobs that were offshoots of those steel mills, basically one of them completely closed almost. All those jobs being gone, then all you had left was Well, you had a ripple effect is what happened. And the town hauled it out real quick.
Right. Well, now the problem is that the manufacturing jobs are almost all gone. And all the money is fake. And the economy is basically running on fucking air until somebody realizes that all the money is fake and they don't want it no more. And hopefully Babylon will fall. But it's all bullshit. It's a total bullshit economy today. Where if I live in a town and in a factory town and I'm not able to work in the factory, which should be a higher paying job, then I'm going to settle for like being a launderer or being a butcher or something that's a slightly lower paying job, but serves those people that in a function that they need. Today, everybody wants to be a car salesman or an insurance broker.
Or a banker.
Yeah, and just steal from people.
Real estate agent.
Yeah, that's another pretty lame fucking job. Fake job. Just rake 6% off every home sale. For putting an ad in the paper. So you don't even have to go get somebody to buy the house. You just put an ad in the paper and somebody will call you. And you get 6%.
Yeah. And you know, technology was supposed to pretty much erase real estate agents or deplete that, you know, profession, but it didn't.
No, because you still have to go through an agent. In some states, you don't need an agent. In Florida, you don't need an agent. You could sign it. You could buy a house on a bill of sale. I sold my property on a bill of sale. All we needed was a title company. So the fees were about, I split the fees with the person that bought my property when I sold my property last year, where my old house was destroyed.
Yeah.
And it still came to like $1,200, like $600 each to sell a lot for $28,000.
Yeah, people do private sales where I'm from too, and avoid the whole 4 to 6% real estate fees.
Yeah, if I listed my property with a real estate agent to sell it, I probably would have sold it for the same price, and I would have paid 6% plus the $1,200 in fees. I'd have probably paid $3,000 or whatever. It's absurd. Fuck real estate agents. It's scam. It's just a cushy job that's a scam. They don't do anything for you.
And their only skill is having a silver tongue.
Yeah, smile. A lot of them were women. All they had to do was run their fingers through their hair and smile, and they sold the house. Because some weak-ass simp guy is going to fall for that. And it's over with, and she makes 6% of $300,000 or $400,000. Yeah, there's a lot of jobs that are just scams. I'm not mocking anybody that might be in real estate. And if you're stuck in that, that's the world we live today, in which we live today. But there's a lot of jobs that are just scams.
I have a list of jobs of people I hate. Doctors, they're on the list.
Well, in an honest world, you wouldn't need a real estate agent if the world was honest. And no, you wouldn't need a doctor. Yeah, you might need physicians like to set broken bones and give you stitches when you cut yourself and stuff like that. I get that's honest. That's an honest vocation. And not everybody can do it. It takes some skill to do it, right? But most of the things doctors do today, that they put a stick in your ass and give you a prescription for some pills. I mean, it's all sorcery. Yeah.
It says here, the mistress of witchcrafts. you well-favored harlot, you mistress of witchcraft.
Well, this definitely parallels the fall of Mystery Babylon, but that's inevitable that these descriptions fit any empire. So it's prophetic in the far vision point of view, there's no doubt, but it's prophetic for that reason.
Yeah, in the Revelation, isn't Satan using Pharmakia to deceive the whole world?
Yes.
And here we have Selleth nations through her whoredoms and witchcraft.
Even Mystery Babylon deceived the world through her sorceries. Revelation 18:23. For by thy sorceries were all nations deceived.
And it says the same thing about the old ancient Babylon in Isaiah 2, as a type for Mystery Babylon. Speaking of this being a type, I think there's a good cross-reference for verse 19, where it says, there is no healing of your bruise, your wound is grievous. And that's in Jeremiah. Where in Jeremiah chapter 51, it says, Babylon is suddenly fallen and destroyed. Howl for her, take balm for her pain. If so, she may be healed. We would have healed Babylon, but she is not healed. Forsake her. And that makes me think of all the Build Back Better bullshit they're trying to propagate now.
Yeah, Build Back Better. They're not going to build a damn thing. All of America's cities are destroyed, and they're never going to rebuild them.
Certainly not with a bunch of niggers. A bunch of African Americans.
What the hell do you do with Chicago? How do you build back better Chicago when it's a total cesspool and a slum, and it's 100% niggers or 85% niggers? I haven't been there in a while, but we drove through Chicago in, I think it was 2016. Melissa and I drove through Chicago just so that I could get her to take my picture outside Eli James's house. I don't know if y'all saw that picture, but I put it in the forum. And we could have drove around Chicago, right? But we were going to Wisconsin to see a CI couple we know up there. And we spent a weekend with them. I did two podcasts from there. So we ran by Eli James's house on the way to, and Chicago was a huge cesspool. And Eli James was living all those years. He sold his house recently, you know. Eli's wife died, and he sold his house this year. And he moved to Harrison, Arkansas. But he lived in Chicago all this time in a spick neighborhood across the street from a spick church. How the hell did he do that? It was crazy. The neighborhood was horrible.
Well, I reckon I could rebuild Chicago, but not without hurting feelings.
Yeah, something's going to reach up to the bridles of the horses.
Yeah. Blood. Yeah, it would have to rebuild that. It you would have to. Build Back Better is just a lie. They're not moving the manufacturing plants back to the U.S. The steel mills aren't coming back.
Yeah, what does Build Back Better even mean? Turn it into even more of a shithole?
Yep. It's a Trojan horse.
Today, a friend of ours, the guy, a neighbor kid here, he's Brad's age. He's about 28. He was, Brad got a call at 7 a.m. this morning. I was sitting at my desk. And Brad got a call. And this friend, this neighbor of ours, asked Brad to pick him up down the road because he just got T-boned. He got T-boned by an illegal immigrant from Honduras that had no insurance. So his pickup truck was destroyed. but it's illegal immigrant with no insurance. How the fuck do you recover from that?
Yeah, the government, Robert.
Yeah, Joe Biden will write him a check to cover for everything, I know. The government ain't going to pay him shit.
That's bullshit.
He might get the insurance company should pay off the loan for him, but then any money he put in that truck is lost. And he's never going to get it from that fucking squat monster.
We're basically,
I think I would just go to his house, get the address of the accident report, go to his house. I want to shoot everybody I see to get my money back, to get my satisfaction. I swear. That's what we should do. But we can't do that because then we'd be in prison because they are obviously more important than we are because they could drive around without insurance and they don't own a fucking, so they're never going to have to be, pay for that vehicle. It's crazy. So that happened today. They ran a red light right into a stream of traffic. Boom.
User disconnected from your
channel. And just bounced off his friggin' pickup truck and destroyed it. Both of his wheels were, he was going so, the Honduran was going so fast, he totaled the front end of his car. And the pickup truck, both wheels were knocked off the chassis. I don't know, it was a Toyota, right? And it's looks like it's totaled.
I don't think NOWAT should be able to use our technology, honestly. When they fly airplanes, they do whatever, this is always the end result. So I don't know what they're doing.
User,
yeah, right.
I remember a story where a Negress was in a high-powered sports car, and she's coming up to a red light, but she's going too fast. So instead of slowing down, she decides to speed up because in her mind, if she goes as fast as she can, she'll clear the intersection without, you know, getting in an accident, without getting hit because she's going so fast. So she hit like 180 miles an hour straight through the intersection and hit several cars and they blew up on impact.
Wow.
That's the way they think. She thought she would get through unscathed because she hit 180 miles an hour.
Yeah, anybody who thinks that non-whites can drive should just check out those Chinese traffic cameras.
Yeah, for sure. Asians are terrible drivers.
Yeah, I don't know who's worse though, Chinese or Indians. I mean, I dealt with both of them when I was still a young man in Jersey City. We had a huge Chinese population, a huge Indian population. They lived in different parts of town, but it was horrible driving through those neighborhoods. It was terrible. The Indians all have like 2-inch thick glasses and they're driving. Figure that one out.
You guys want to cut it or do you have some more to say?
I think we're about done with Nam. And we'll see Habakkuk next week.